Hello and welcome to Escape into Storytelling. I'm Jennifer Bradley and this is a chapter from my self-published novel, Virago. New episodes drop each Monday and all chapters will be available at the end of the book. As always, there is no charge. Virago is intended for a mature audience and today's episode contains language and violence. If you missed last week's episode, it is available from the same podcast source. Now please, sit back and escape into storytelling with me in today's episode. Chapter 18. A pair grows closer. Neville takes a chance. Parade day comes. Weeks passed. The shortened days of autumn cast a pall over the city. Breath misted in the cold night. Trees lost their leaves, their branches tossing in the wind like the locked antlers of battling stags. Although no official curfew was in place, people hurried to finish their business and get home before sundown. Adelaide made visits to the Ann and Belle, but Miriam was often out. Annabelle was glad enough of her company and invited her to stay in the little room under the stairs. She spent time with Maggie, Jessie, or Eora at the market or elsewhere. She spent many nights with Luthus. The little room above Gert's shop was warmed by their entwined bodies, or cheered by shared meals and chat. He taught her Hoathi words and phrases, and she told him about life in the woods, or things she learned at the academy. One morning they lay together in the old bed, legs tangled under the blankets. She traced the scar on his chest with an outstretched thumb. He watched her thumb as it moved, smiling. "Remember how I got that?"
"I drank with a broken bottle."
She rested her chin on his shoulder.
"Your third year."
He raised his arm and pointed to a shiny spot on the back of his bicep.
"The lady with the pot of boiling water? She didn't want to pay her taxes."
White teeth flashed in his grin.
"No, she didn't."
He raised her hand and pointed at the scar on the back of her wrist.
"Some briars," he said, looking to her for confirmation.
"A fight with a stag?"
But she smiled at him and nodded. His fingertip found a dark circle on her shoulder.
"A sharp nail sticking out of some wood?"
"A bear's fang."
His brown eyes were big and kind. He pulled her close and lifted the hair away from her back. His fingers traced the ridges and lines on the scars there.
"Your stepfather."
She nodded.
"From the switch. We all had turns with it, though." "It's too beautiful a morning for talk of those days. Come on."
She clambered across him, stepping off the bed. Her dress hung from the bedpost, and she reached for it.
"Ready to go to the library?"
He motioned to her body.
"How can you stand there in front of me naked and expect me to go somewhere?"
He laughed when she tossed his pants at him.
"Come on. May only speaks once a month. You promised."
The librarian's hollow voice filled the hall as she read from the slip of paper.
"The question is, where do the Hoathi come from?"
Adelaide glanced up at Luthus. Across the hall, many dusky, freckled faces became intent.
"The Hoathi originally came from southern Braedochia. They lived in stone huts and farmed the land, but were conquered and driven out by the Empire 1800 years ago. They settled in the large cluster of islands now known as Hoath and have lived there ever since. 400 years ago, they were conquered again by the Empire as it made its way across the Sandoval Sea. Although people speak of Hoathi and Hoath people, the Hoathi are actually dozens of distinct countries with some similarities. Southern Hoathi live close to the sea and domesticate dolphins to help them catch fish. People there learn to swim before they can walk."
Luthus leaned down to whisper in Adelaide's ear.
"My great-grandparents came from Aiena, one of the southern islands where everyone has boats and a pet dolphin. Funny, I can't even swim."
"Me neither."
At someone's mild shush, he straightened. The librarian's assistant was digging through the vase for another question. Adelaide looked at the freckles dusting Luthus's cheeks and those of other Hoathi-descended people in the room.
"I wonder where my people came from, or even if there are any others like Father and I. There must be others. We must come from somewhere. Unless we spring out of fairy rings like the creatures in Miriam's stories. Or perhaps Father was cursed somehow and carried on to me? I still don't know what question I want to ask either. How can I ask without revealing myself?
Huh. Luthus grunted and pointed with his chin toward the door by the librarian's dais, indicating a watch member there.
See the one by the door? That's Lieutenant Igar at a Copper Bells. He looks like he's on duty. I wonder what he's doing here.
He drifted through the crowd to chat with Igar, a black man wearing boiled leather. The next question was about the Empire. The librarian explained the role the Empire played in building the city's aqueducts, roads, and sewers.
They're always at the back of everything, the Empire. Just when you think you've figured it out, you learn something new. Stories behind stories.
Luthus wandered back.
Igar says there's a special detail assigned to the librarian the last few weeks. She's been getting death threats.
What? Why?
A few annoyed faces turned toward them. The pair lowered their voices.
It's pretty common for someone in the public eye to get them. But hers say things like, you're a demon, stop practicing witchcraft and such. People have always been afraid of her since she's, well, not human.
Adelaide's brow furrowed. But she served the city for so long. Over 100 years.
Aye. People never think straight when they're scared.
No. No, they don't. Not at all.
She looked up at him, her grey eyes watchful.
Are you afraid of her?
He shrugged.
Maybe, if she came at me with a broken bottle.
He raised an eyebrow.
She's got quite a reach.
Neville stared at the pub's wooden sign. A mug was centered over crossed clubs, indicating he stood in front of the Rounds. It was the unofficial pub of the East Coast Watch.
Where else would you find work in one of the biggest gangs of the city was looking for you? Carver said.
I suppose it makes a sort of sense. And the Watch aren't looking for me. Maybe this'll help me keep it that way.
The door was propped open, so he stepped inside. The pub was both like and unlike the thousands of other pubs he'd been in during his life. Since it was morning, there were only a few shapes drinking at tables or the bar, but most of them wore watch armor. He recognized the man behind the bar as the proprietor from Carver's description. An old man, white hair and a beard, big, gone to pot. He was in the watch at some point, not sure when or how long, and he's missing a hand.
Hobson, Neville asked as he strode to the bar.
Hobson, cradling a mug in the crook of his elbow as he polished it with his remaining hand, had watched Neville come in.
I hear you're looking for help.
Hobson nodded, his blue eyes bright and frank.
I am.
I see this isn't going to be easy.
I'm your man. Used to be a tinker, and I make a good cartwright and carpenter, too. And I have people to vouch for me.
Not untrue. Annabelle and Marion said they would. Adelaide probably would if I had thought to ask.
You any good as a fighter? They gets a bit rowdy on payday.
I've been in a few fights.
Also, not untrue.
Hobson ran an eye up and down the slim frame.
Well, I've seen big men felled by little ones. Takes all sorts. Are you a drunk?
Not at the moment.
You are or you're not, as far as I'm concerned.
Neville's jaw tensed and a pulse beat at his temple.
I am, then, but I don't drink any more.
Hobson nodded. He set the mug down and picked up another.
Lots of people looking for work right now. Lots of beer lying around in here. I'd rather hire a man who knows he's a drunk than somebody who ain't found out yet. I'll hire you if you gave it up, but drunks working around drink don't last long.
I can work.
Hobson shrugged.
Suit yourself. You'll do everything but handle the drinks. Move the furniture, clean, carry, take deliveries, keep the coffee brewed. Ducat a week and one bowl of stew a day. You can't sleep here, but there's a shack round back where you might catch a little nap now and then. Keeps the rain off, but not the cold. Interested?
Neville said that he was.
All right, then. Start now.
The former tinker nodded.
Broom's over there.
After the Master of Hunt's demonstration and the conversation with Plowright, Winston wanted nothing more than to find Gerald and discuss all he had seen. Naturally, this meant that every other matter in the world needed his attention. He sat in his office on the second floor of the Leader Street Watch House. It was a small room, more like a ship's cabin than an office, and he'd brought in a new, sturdy chair to replace the old one. The desk had belonged to Figuerosa as well, but it couldn't be helped. He finished a payroll report and reached for the heap of notes from the suggestion box.
"Now I know why Gerald and Figgy slept in their offices. I thought it was just an odd habit, but it's really because by the time you're done walking your rounds, doing inspections, reading and writing reports, handling payroll, weeding through the suggestions box, and doing other damn thing, you're ready to pass out."
He lifted up a note. The scrawled handwriting requested a complement of horrors for the watch house, a hot springs in the basement, and pay raises best described as astronomical.
"Hilarious." He crumpled up the note. "Sometimes I wish we didn't encourage reading and writing in the watch. Not that this was really writing. Whoever it was misspelled hot."
He picked up a note from a local milliner requesting extra security for the festival.
"Mr. Bondaway, for the fourth time. I've scheduled double shifts and still they want more. I heard some of them are hiring members of the Brotherhood. That's all we need."
He gritted his teeth and crumbled a request for them fancy meals like what the Duchess eats.
"A bunch of ex-sailors, former pirates, and people kicked out of the watch for being too violent or corrupt hanging about. There'll be enough excitement with half the city drunk or smoking shala and running around at all hours of the night."
Outside, he heard Bunny braying in her stall.
"And to think, I'm leaving Luthus in charge."
The last request was for real coffee, not shit.
"Well, at least it's spelled right."
The shop was closed the day of the parade, but Adelaide rose at her usual time. She dressed warmly for the long walk to Gert's house.
"Luthus is working. Jessie, Maggie, and Eora are all with their families. I wish Miriam were here. I barely see her anymore."
Despite the cold air, the city crackled with excitement. Colored streamers and banners hung from roofs, eaves, balconies, and anything else that could be thrown over, and hung fluttering in the breeze. Flowers and colored chalk powders were strewn in the street, and ribbons hung from bare tree limbs. It was less a riot of color than absolute chaos. The people who were out at this hour didn't seem dressed for the festival, but there was a feeling in the air as heady as incense, and everyone seemed busy but excited. People smiled, chatted, sang, and seemed more inclined to wave hello to strangers. She bid good mornings as she walked. Mr. Fish was a vegetable farmer who brought produce to several stands in East Coast. "It's why I picked my name," he explained once, which only deepened the mystery. Adria, a chandler's daughter taking over her sister's business. Guncalvo, a baker who sold bread and rolls. She waved to Mr. Soupbush's window, and a beard in hand emerged to wave back. She passed under the old gentleman, reached the Weldon Road, and followed it past Bristol Square, where the stage and die were being draped with decorations. The modest houses of Glendale gave way to the larger, more well-to-do houses of Westmont.
"Here we are. I've never been to Gert and Ellen's during the day."
Hazelnut House had a little garden alongside, with only a few hints of green. A scarecrow leaned drunkenly forward, with its head hanging down, its arms up, as if threatening a hug. Alan answered her knock, still in his pajamas and with his hair in a bun.
"Come in, come in. Ooh, it's cold out there."
He ushered her in. He took her wrap and hung it on one of several hooks in the mud room next to his long green coat and Gert's huge bright yellow one. There were scarves, hats, and a pile of boots. Gert appeared in the archway, dressed as if he were going to work.
"Is it her? Did she? Oh, Alan, put on your clothes!"
"We're not going out for an hour yet."
Gert fuffed and turned away. They followed him into a kitchen redolent of breakfast.
"Want some food? We ate, but I could do you some bacon and eggs."
She did, and Alan tied his old stained apron on and began cracking eggs. Gert sat down to a plate with some jammed toast on it and folded his hand around a steaming coffee mug.
"So, are you excited?"
Aye, I've never been to a festival before, she replied, sitting down next to him.
I suppose they didn't have them back in... Where were you from again?
At the stove, Alan tisked.
It's not like she doesn't still have the accent. People come from all over, Alan.
The high country. No festivals there.
Well, there was the Harvest Festival, but it wasn't half as loud as a small pub on Tuesday night around here.
From the corner of her eye, she saw Alan cock his head at her.
He wants to ask about my life there, but he won't. He never does. Maybe I don't mind if he asks. Maybe I want to tell people about it.
She sipped some of her own coffee.
But not today. Some other day. Today is for fun and cheer and good friends.
After they ate and the washing up was done, Alan ran upstairs for the rest of his clothes. She helped Gert on with his enormous yellow coat, standing on the bench to do so. Through it all, he chattered about the friend they were meeting and the house where they would be watching the parade.
You like Patrick. He's hard to explain, but I'm sure you'll like him. His house sits right on one of those streets that the parade is going down, so we'll be able to sit on his balcony and see the whole thing. No dirty, crowded street for us.
When Gert and Alan turned and walked through some huge, wrought iron gates and up a gravel driveway to a mansion, Adelaide followed without thinking. Giant, well-appointed houses were common in Westmont, but she was more acquainted with the iron gates that circled them than the houses themselves, which seemed as far away as distant mountains. Now she found herself actually on the grounds of one. Around them sprawled an expertly manicured lawn and hedges. Statues stood guard, and the house itself sat on a fair-sized plot of land and apparently went all the way back to the following street. The house had at least 40 rooms, and the front doors were 10 feet tall.
I've made deliveries to places like this. There's probably a servant's path over.
The men marched to the front door. Once there, they banged on it, bold as brass. A servant answered. He wore a fine frock coat and a powdered wig as big and white as a sheep fleece. He greeted them with a smile and a nod.
Good morning, Jerome. We're here to see Patrick.
The servant stepped back.
This way, gentlemen.
As Gert moved, Jerome's eye fell on her.
And lady...
She stared at him.
Alan took her arm. Adelaide's enough, Jerome. She hasn't got a last name yet.
Indeed, sir.
Whatever Jerome thought of this was hidden under layers of training and discipline. The four stood in a cavernous hallway lit by towering glass windows. A grand staircase split and curled around to the second floor. The floor was patterned in huge tiles of white and dark green marble. The servant helped Gert and Alan off with their coats. Before he had a chance to ask for hers, she shrugged off her shawl. Jerome looked at her, then exchanged a quick glance with Alan before leaning down.
No, dear. You keep yours. Ladies keep their wraps in the house.
She nodded and pulled it back on, her cheeks pinkening. The servant led them up the stairs, through some double doors and into a large, airy drawing room. Several couches were covered with pillows. Bookcases groaned against the walls, and in a corner stood a harp. Tall, narrow glass windows hid behind rich curtains.
What a pretty room. I wonder why it smells like old dirty laundry in here, or rags soaked in wine.
How lovely, she said, rather than remark on the smell.
And we'll be able to see everything from here.
Indeed, Miss Adelaide.
Jerome folded his hands before him and asked,
Will there be anything else, Master?
The question hung in the air.
Something coughed and cleared its throat with a sound like a drain backing up. A pile of clothes on one of the couches responded.
Yes! Yes, Jerome. A breakfast tray, please.
The clothes sat up, revealing a man with a handkerchief over his head. He pulled it off and coughed into it.
Orange juice, toast, juniper jam, a raw egg, and a tumbler of gin.
Very good, sir, Jerome responded and was gone.
That explains the smell.
Once the door shut, Alan and Gert erupted into laughter. The form on the couch regarded them through puffed red eyes. The man looked as if he hadn't changed his rumpled clothes in a week or slept in as long. He settled his weary gaze on Adelaide.
I'm sorry. Have we met?
No, sir, she replied, trying to ignore Gert and Alan.
No matter. And you, too. You might have told me we'd have company. I'd have made more of an effort,
he said, swinging his legs around. One foot was sockless. She thought him at first to be young, but realized now he was in his late 30s at least. He was plain until he smiled, and with his dark hair and eyes, reminded her of Neville.
Be honest, it's not just his colouring. He reminds you of Neville because he's a few drops shy of being pickled.
Alan held out a hand.
Adelaide, this is Sir Patrick Galbraith.
How do you do?
She curtsied as Gert has instructed her. He stared at her. Then, as happened with everyone else, the spark of understanding caught in his eyes once he'd figured out her accent.
Oh, yes. I'm doing very well, thank you.
His parents are Lord and Lady Galbraith, master and mistress of... What was it again? Patrick waved him off.
I don't know, finance or something.
Adelaide is Gert's assistant. Sir Galbraith rubbed his head. His hair stood up like a forest after a hurricane.
Assistant? You've never brought one of those here before.
He must really like you.
We do.
Gert patted her head. Patrick spread his arms.
Welcome to my house, then, Adelaide. Pleased to meet you. Thomas is around here somewhere. Or he was. What about your brothers?
Patrick yawned, scratching his chest.
They're watching from the castle. Father wanted to introduce Wilfred to some of the other table members, and Lionel's attached to Wilfred. Mother's down the street at Lady Emerson's, so we'll have the house to ourselves.
Adelaide's gaze strayed to the walls of books surrounding them. She squinted at the shelves, trying to read titles. Alan noticed.
May I show her the books?
A carelessly flung hand indicated that they might help themselves, although the young noble seemed amused.
You read?
I'm learning,
she replied as she and Alan approached the shelves. Alan was familiar with the books and pulled out several volumes for her to page through. In a book of maps, she showed Alan and Gert where the ruins of Avaras were. Patrick's hangover cure arrived. He cracked the raw egg into a tumbler, then added some of the juniper jam and gin from a fresh bottle. He quaffed it, made a face, then drank the orange juice in one go. A well-dressed man appeared in the doorway. He had bright blue, permanently surprised eyes and a round, rabbit-like face. He seemed put off when he found Patrick with company, but only for a moment. He moved forward to shake her hand upon being introduced.
How lovely, how lovely! We'll have a grand view of the parade from up here, don't you think?
Better than the view from the cabbage patch, Patrick said, eyeing Thomas.
Thomas gave Patrick what could only be described as a warning look before turning back to their guests.
Found the books, have you? Doesn't he have an amazing collection? Nearly all first editions.
Some servants arrived with more trays, and food was set up on the balcony. Adelaide fidgeted, watching the servants.
It feels wrong to just stand here. Should I ask if they need help?
Alan came up beside her.
It puts me off, too. I keep wanting to go and help, but you're not supposed to. They're supposed to be invisible.
She looked into the green eyes.
It's strange, isn't it?
He nodded.
I don't think I could ever get used to it. My mother is a servant. Gert and I have cook, but half the time I wind up cooking anyway.
As she watched Alan watching the servants, Adelaide had a sudden realization.
I bet Alan wanted me to come. Gert probably wouldn't have thought of it, but Alan wanted someone to talk to.
Once the balcony was made ready, the group moved out onto it. Cushions made the iron chairs more comfortable. Down below, the street was lined with people. They made a soft, reassuring clamor, like rain beating on windows. Most of her friends' talk was of things she knew nothing about, so she sat and listened. They spoke of a famous playwright they all knew who had broken his arm, and whether Thomas's father was going to invest in another shipping concern.
"And what about you, Alan? Paint any backdrops for controversial plays recently?"
Patrick asked, a devilish gleam in his eye. He dropped all pretense and was halfway through the gin bottle that arrived with his breakfast.
"As a matter of fact, no," Alan said, glancing at Gert. "They didn't ask me this year."
"Probably thought better of putting it on. Nobody will want to see that play again for years if they have any sense."
"Actually..."
Again, Alan glanced at Gert, who seemed resolute on staying out of the discussion.
"Actually, we're seeing it tonight. We have extra tickets if you're interested."
"I thought..." "Well, I changed my mind, didn't I? We'll talk about it later," Gert said, his neck reddening.
"Oh, no, I think we're dining with Patrick's parents tonight," Thomas said, the blue eyes darting about.
Patrick grunted around a mouthful of gin. Alan glanced at Adelaide.
"Would you like to come?"
She grinned and nodded. Thomas leaned back.
"I'm surprised they're putting it on, that a venue would even show it."
"This venue is. It's not a regular playhouse, it's a warehouse. I know some of the actors in it, but the manager got all new crew for the production."
"Where?"
"Dockside."
"What?"
Patrick looked at him, sobered by the news.
"Come on, Alan, you wouldn't go down there. Not these days."
Alan made as if to reply, but the sound of faraway trumpets cut him off. Had Adelaide been down on the street, she would have had little idea of what was going on, and no way to find out, since nothing but the loudest screams were heard over the roar of the crowd. On the balcony, she was able to hear and see everything, as well as enjoy the constant commentary of Thomas. He narrated every moment of the hour-long procession, and she had the feeling that he would have done the same whether the others were there or not. He chattered away like a squirrel in a burning tree. First came the palace guard, their fine scale armor gleaming and white-plumed helmets whipping in the breeze. They carried tall tower shields that bore the Duchess's colors.
"There's the Duke!"
Alistair sat astride a huge charcoal-gray charger, waving and grinning at the crowd as if he were made for nothing else. He gesticulated so wildly one could imagine him taking flight to soar over the city like a cackling, hairy comet. The Duchess Amandia Sirton was nestled in an open-topped carriage amid pillows and white furs. She wore the pale sea-green and white that were her colors, and the crown on her head flashed and sparkled like fallen stars. The tiny, withered hand raised now and then to wave to the crowd, igniting a storm of screams and clapping. 8 milk-white stallions with pink noses pulled her carriage. Their black halters had mother-of-pearl inlay, and affixed to each forehead was a single spiral horn of silver. Sea-green ribbons woven into their braided manes and tails trailed in the breeze. After the Duchess came several waves of nobles, starting with several in carriages and ending with some riding horses. Thomas named every single one of them, almost in the same breath. Gert gasped. He leaned on the iron railing, pointing.
"There's Wynne!"
Following the nobles were the captains of the city, riding side by side. Winston sat in the middle on a giant golden horse. Resplendent in his white gloves, ceremonial armor, and red cape, Winston sat tall, waving and nodding to the crowd as the line made its way down the street. Alan slung an arm around Gert's considerable waist, their hands linked.
"If only Papa were still alive," Gert said, his eyes shining. "He'd be so proud."
Winston smiled and waved at the crowd, but his friends and family saw his clenched jaws and the horse's body held between his knees in a death grip.
"Look at him, he looks miserable. I wish I were a terrible person. I'd throw something to spook his horse."
Patrick let out a bark of laughter.
"And there's Luthus."
Patrick cocked his head and squinted at Gert.
"Is he the one you're always on about? Something about the wrong pie?"
Alan collapsed against the rail with his head on his arms, shaking with laughter. Gert beamed.
That's the one. He's awful. Sorry, Adelaide, but he is.
He nudged her with his great hip. She grinned at Gert as she waved down to Luthus. When he blew her a kiss, the entire balcony let out a great, "Ah!" and teased her as the rest of the watch column went by. The crowd quieted, as if unsure what was happening. No one followed the watch. The empty street yawned, and people at the edges of the crowd leaned forward, looking up the street.
"Is it over?"
"No, the merchants haven't gone by yet. Or the rangers."
Gert stood on tiptoe and peered back up the street.
"Yes, I can see the rest where the street comes down the hill."
Alan craned his neck. "I wonder what's..." The answer rounded the corner. A hush fell on the crowd, moving along with the newly appointed Lord Commander of the Watch. Victor Woodburn walked alone in shabby blacks.
"He can't expect anyone to cheer," Patrick murmured. "I wonder if they made him come."
"What are those?" Thomas said, aghast.
6 enormous dogs walked with the spymaster. The size of calves, they bore long, toothy heads, small ears, and long legs. Their coats were brindled, and each wore a studded black collar. No leashes restrained the dogs, and the crowd was pressing back to get away from them.
"Those are the type of dogs Father was probably thinking of when he told me to be afraid of dogs. They look like barracuda on legs."
"Those are his hunting hounds," Alan said, all levity having ebbed from him. "He had them when he lived here in the city before." The spymaster made his way along the cobbles, ignoring the crowd that wasn't cheering, ignoring the confetti and colored chalk in the street, ignoring the streamers that still drifted above his head. The dogs kept pace, never straying and needing no lead or correction. Soon he was just in front of the house.
"There's something about him that..."
The dogs looked up. The man's head followed. The single eye roved over her without interest. His gaze fell back to the street. Soon he and his dogs were out of sight. Thomas stared at her in fascination.
"Well, I say, that was... I wonder what..."
"Indeed," Patrick said.
He blinked as if to clear his eyes and gave her another look.
"Perhaps you met him somewhere," Thomas offered.
"He wears disguises and goes out into the city sometimes. Maybe he recognized you from somewhere."
"Maybe."
Her hands wrapped around the iron rail.
"Why am I worried? I've done nothing wrong. There are people in the city who've committed real crimes. He'd worry about them before he worried about me. And anyway, I haven't done anything wrong. Those men were killers, plain and simple. Carver said so. Neville said so. I protected my family, and anyone else would have done the same."
"Still want to see that play?" Gert whispered to Alan.
"More than ever." The servants appeared and replaced the snacks with more food. Sliced roast beef, a pot of horseradish sauce, hot pastries, 3 kinds of cheese, apples, pears, and grapes.
"So what did you think of your first parade?"
"It was long."
The others chuckled at her summation.
"And everyone seemed so happy and cheerful."
Gert nodded.
"Aye. Wynne calls that the calm before the storm. They've all had a pint with breakfast, but nobody's had time to get good and soused yet. They're happy now, but they'll be drunk and fighting later." "Some of us got started last night," Patrick mused. He was lying prone on the divan.
"Or early this morning, depending on how you look at it."
"And you'll probably pass out before sundown," Thomas remarked, his lips tightening.
"God's willing, I hope I don't tire out before then. It's all down to pacing, really."
Thomas looked as if he had much more to say on this subject and that Patrick would hear it later. Alan and Gert shared a glance.
"Well, we were going to have a nap this afternoon before the festivities tonight. We'd better get home."
Patrick scoffed. He gestured at the wall with the bottle.
"There are 30-something empty rooms in this house. Have a nap here. You could sleep in 2 at once." How could they sleep in two rooms at once? Thomas sniffed.
In a doorway. I do it all the time.
Gert and Alan shared another look, and Gert took up the cause.
Oh, it's fine. We have to get our costumes anyway.
Well, all right then. Ta. Nice meeting you, Adelaide.
Thomas merely waved at them. Jerome saw them out.
Just the other day, Thomas said Patrick was cutting back, Gert said as they headed down the driveway. That didn't look like cutting back.
Alan nodded, looking troubled. Patrick used to joke that starting too early in the day meant you were trying too hard. He said real gentlemen didn't start drinking until afternoon, when they woke up. Adelaide snorted.
I can see what you mean about Patrick being hard to explain. I liked him, though.
Gert waved a hand.
Patrick can be lovely, but he was in a mood today. When he's like that, I'd rather be somewhere else. Come have lunch with us, then you can go get your costume and come with us to the play.
Costume?
You do have one. We've been working on costumes for people for the last 2 months and talking about them every day.
I guess I just sort of forgot.
No matter.
Gert gestured for her to come along.
We have some clothes in the house. Sometimes people give me old things to fix up and sell. I'm sure we can find you something.
I have to have a costume?
Alan put a finger on his chin and thought.
Well, no. But if you don't, you have to buy the first round. It's an ancient, time-honored tradition.
Fuff. Ancient as in you made it up just now.
This concludes Chapter 18 of Virago. Stay tuned for the next chapter, Chapter 19, in which the city cuts loose for the long-anticipated Heroes Festival, but it's not the good time Adelaide imagined. If you want to read along, Virago will be available in abridged print or ebook format from Amazon later this year. If you enjoyed this work, please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss an episode of Escape into Storytelling. Thank you for supporting independent and self-published authors like me. Until next time, be seeing you.